The more we trade, the less we tend to kill each other. The European construction after the Second World War was, we want to make sure that German pigs can eat corn from France. Because the next time they are going to fight, the pigs will die on one side, the crops will start to rot on the other, and on both sides, people will say, it's not a good idea.
Hi, I'm Catherine Park. Today I speak with David Laborde, the director of the Agri-Food Economics and Policy Division. David also leads the economic modeling and analysis work for FAO. We talk about the economics of trade, the true cost of food, and the art of making policy to address difficult trade-offs. Welcome to the work we do. David, how does an international trade economist like yourself end up at the Food and Agriculture Organization of the UN?
Catherine, like everything in life, is a bit of planning and a bit of luck. But so yes, early in my life, I wanted to understand more about economics. And I always was interested about what connect people. And if you add economics with connection, it's trade. Trade across nation, trade across people. And at the end, trade is about to achieve a more peaceful world. Because as an economist, we try to understand how we allocate scarce resources. Mm-hmm. And either I take it from you or I trade it. And trade is about peace. And I'm also a French economist.
Okay.
And if you start to combine the French economist with trade, you will see a long tradition. One is Léon Valras. That is the father of what we call the general equilibrium.
Mm-hmm.
And that had led me to do more modeling.
Mm-hmm.
But also, he was a big advocate for free trade, but always thinking that it will lead to world peace. And you know, sometimes people say, oh, if you're upset with free trade, you just believe in markets. No, we need market and state. And Léon Valras was presenting himself as both a free trader and a socialist, for instance.
Huh. So he was an inspiration as you did your studies?
Yes,
okay.
Because what we want is to make sure that we have a peaceful world. That I think that's the basic thing we try to achieve. And that actually is the mission of the UN.
Okay.
So that's why already I am part of the UN.
Okay.
But then we can think about why food. When I started, I work a lot on different trade and trade negotiations. And actually in trade negotiation, you want to make sure you have the right numbers, the right evidence. So me, I was always interested in making sure we can bring the right evidence in discussion that matters. But quickly, and even if agriculture is relatively a small share of global GDP, and just 15 or 20% of global trade, it's a major item in trade negotiation. You will see it in global trade talks, like during the Doha round,
uh-huh.
where things get stuck on uh-huh. agricultural issue.
Uh-huh.
Or even today, if you look at the EU-Mercosur discussion, agriculture is a key element.
Why is that?
And I think, so it's because food is a commodity, but it's much more. It's about national security. It's about identity. It's about the welfare of people. It's about the well-being of people. So yes, trade and food trade is a business. And actually, we are trading food around the world for millennia. But it's not too surprising because the first thing we produced was food.
Mm.
But also it's something that people need. And as soon as we start to build cities, to build empires, where people are, like in Rome 2,000 years ago, and where the land and water are, can be disconnected. So you need to move the food from the place where you produce it, and you can produce it in the right condition, to the place where you will consume it. And so that's why trade matters. That's why how we manage this trade matters. And at the end, that's why step by step, I move from a more generic view on trade and the economy to looking at food and agriculture because it's an essential part of our life, essential part of trade, but also a very sensitive one.
Why do you say it's a very sensitive one?
Because it is connected to national security. Mm-hmm. Food can be a weapon. Mm-hmm. Food is something mm-hmm. that you cannot say, oh, you know, during 1 month, we are not going to eat. I mean, worst case scenario, during 1 month, you may not decide to drive a lot. You know, we have seen it during COVID. Mm-hmm. People were not moving. People still have to eat. And government care about it.
Yeah.
But also, it's where you have something very particular. You have a fixed asset, that is land.
Mm-hmm.
You can move people. You can move capital. You cannot move land.
That's correct.
And that will have very important implication in terms of political economy, in terms of income for people. And that's, I think, it. You know, the political economy on one hand, the fact that food is much more than, as I've said, a commodity.
Mm-hmm.
That is something that every country needs
mm-hmm.
when not every country have.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we deal with it differently. So yes, wheat is a commodity. People produce it, sell it, trade it. There is a financial market on it. But also is that what brings us bread and what also connect people.
Right.
The results right. connect people.
Could you perhaps, you know, give an explanation as a macroeconomist a little bit in more detail how trade impacts food security and nutrition?
So trade is a very simple thing. Mm-hmm. You know, there is people that have something and people that need something.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true for the nation.
Mm-hmm.
And normally trade go from someone that can sell you something at a lower price
mm-hmm.
than what you can produce in your own country.
Mm-hmm.
And so we are moving basically places where there are more food to places where there is less food.
Yes.
So, I mean, if you are in the Middle East,
mm-hmm.
you have a long, relatively large population,
mm-hmm.
and the natural resources are scarce. You don't have so much arable land.
Mm-hmm.
Water is limited. So it makes a lot of sense to bring it from places where you have more land,
mm-hmm.
more water.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or you move the product, or you move the people. First, some people doesn't want to move, and it's politically much more complicated to move people than goods. So we move food, and that's helped to get the basic things about this availability of food at a lower cost.
Mm-hmm.
But then food trade, you can also access to products you don't have. So if you are a landlocked country, you don't have access to much, let's say, inner water or lakes, and you still want to eat fish because fish is good for health. So you trade it. Similarly, you want to have access to a nice vegetable oil like olive oil, but you cannot grow olive tree in Norway. So what is the solution? To say to people in Norway, don't...
You buy it from somebody who grows it.
And same thing, you may want also to get fruits. And when it's out of season, okay, it can be nice to eat things from the season. But first, depending where you are in the world, you will not have the same opportunities. And I mean, you can be in Europe and you can enjoy having mango. And it makes much more sense to bring mango from West Africa than to grow them in greenhouses. So with trade, we make food more available
uh-huh.
at a cheaper cost and with more varieties. And that can be good for nutrition.
But aren't we also trying to consume food that are grown nearby locally so that, you know, we cut emissions, we empower the producers in our, you know, in our neighborhood or the region?
So here, I think that we should avoid generalization like far is bad, close is good. You know, you can have your local farmers that is going to use so much water that your local city will not have enough water or they will contaminate water. And at the same time, you can have people at 4,000 kilometers that are doing good things. So it's important to empower everyone to make sure we create market opportunities and the right incentive for people. That also to think that, you know, if your only way to make money in Africa is to grow mangoes, we should not think, okay, we are not going to buy the mango for you, from you, because we are closing development opportunities. So here I just think we need to be rational about things. Local product are often great, can be great, but the fact they are local doesn't make them good. We need to know how they are produced. We need to make sure that they are adapted to the type of nutrition we need. I mean, during decades, because the work was too fragmented, or even countries were too fragmented due to lack of connection, you had major imbalances in terms of micronutrients. Some regions didn't have enough calcium because they were too far from places where we have animal source food or fish and so on. So I really think that, you know, it can make sense to buy and grow food locally, mm-hmm. but in many cases, not everything, because also how you start to draw the line. You live in the US, you have basically the size of a continent to be your supply side. You live in Switzerland. What do you buy? Okay. So no cocoa, no coffee, basically no fruits. Just because you are born in this country, you are doomed to get just what you can find around you? No, that's not what Mindkind has done from the beginning. Now, what we want to make sure is to get trade that has the proper rules, that people understand what they buy, what they consume, that we don't start to do trade that make no sense just because we have, let's say, subsidies or market distortion that say, oh, I am bringing my food from 2,000 kilometers away because 2,000 kilometers away, people don't pay for water, don't pay for electricity, when my local farmers have to do it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there is a number of things that need to be assessed. But I just want to have this clear message, you know, let's go beyond the appearance. And because you are my neighbor, you are not better or worse than someone that exists and walks 2,000 kilometers away.
So say I'm very dependent on food that I import from one country because this country produces so much of what I need. And then something happens to that country. So then that would not be a good thing. I feel that trade could open you up to external shocks that make you vulnerable.
So trade is about creating this connection.
Uh-huh.
And connection make you vulnerable because it make you dependent. But being dependent is also not a bad thing per se. I mean, we are humans, we connect, we are dependent. Is it bad? Some people will say, I want to be self-sufficient on everything. Okay, that's your choice. But in many cases, you are going to be very poor or not have a very enjoyable life. Okay. You don't talk with people, you grow your tomato, and actually, you may have difficulties, and I'm not sure where you will get your fertilizer or your seed, but you live in this bubble of alone, I am not connected, so I am safe. That's your belief.
Mm.
And some countries have tried it, never been very successful, okay? But yes, it creates vulnerability to others. So it means that your problem can become my problem.
Yeah.
But my problem become your problem. It means in all cases, we always also have problems even when we are not connected. In the history of famine in the world, trade has not been the driver of famine. It's about drought. It's about war. It's about things that create a problem in one place and make the people in that place not able to produce food or get access to food. Trade has helped in most of these cases. So now, of course, if you get dependent and your main trade partner has a problem, you may have a problem and a big problem. So that's why actually, when we talk about trade, we talk about markets. We don't recommend to depend just on one partner. Not because we don't want you to trust him or her, it's just because something can happen. And that's the same way that if you go to a few meters from here, we have a very nice market with a lot of small producers and medium producers, but it's a safe place to trade because there is a lot of producers. If I go and I say, okay, today I want fish, and I go to my shop and the shop is closed, I'm not going to end up saying, oh, today no fish. I go to the next shop. Okay, maybe I will pay a different price. Maybe I will not sure about the quality. And that's what we try to do at the global level, to have this multiple place where you can sell and you can buy. And as we have seen, unfortunately, there are conflicts in the world, maybe more conflicts. And when a very large food supplier like Ukraine was disconnected from world markets, it was a problem for the world. But during a few months, markets have adjusted. Country in the Middle East said, we cannot bring the grain from Ukraine, we will bring it from Latin America. And producer in Latin America has decided to produce more. But they were able to produce more because also they have already the infrastructure to trade. They already have decades of investment. And the world of today is actually much more diversified than the world of 60 years ago. And that's why we are able to deal with these different shocks. It can be about real conflict. It can be about trade wars. But people find alternative. Even during COVID, when people are saying, oh, you know, things are... We achieved some record year on international trade for some commodity. Because this was continuing, and we always find options. So I really think that, you know, this illusion that because we are on our own, we are safe, that doesn't happen like this, okay? If you always live alone in your home and you break your leg, I'm sure you will be very happy that some other people come to help you. Even if, yes, maybe during the first several months, your neighbor was making a lot of noise and you were unhappy. But, you know, we are in a planet where, in any case, we share problems. Okay. Thinking that the problems stop at the border is also an illusion. Because when the problem becomes very strong, people move. Conflicts rarely stay within your borders. Animal disease cross border. When you have a drought, rivers dry on both sides of a border. And with trade, we create these linkages, this option that in case of problem, things can help. Just imagine also during COVID, if we say, oh, we are not going to trade any vaccine. Some countries have done it, and that's a natural also response. I keep things for me. But we never know where the next problem will be. And really, over a long period of time, it's through this web of connection.
Yes.
This fabric of destiny that makes us stronger. And that's what we try to do with trade. Because the more we trade, the less we tend to kill each other. The European construction after the Second World War was, we want to make sure that German pigs can eat corn from France. Because the next time they are going to fight, the pigs will die on one side, the crops will start to rot on the other, and on both sides, people will say, it's not a good idea. We create interconnection, we create dependency that connect risk, but that force us to try to find solution together. Now, what I want to say is trade is in itself not good or bad. And more important, it's not things we want to increase or decrease per se. It's a mean. It's a mean to achieve a better hand. And in our case, food security of nutrition. And as a mean, also, it's a catalyst. It's an accelerator. So when you trade and you have the right governance, the right rules, where workers' rights are respected, when nature is protected, trade is going to help everyone and not to create problems. Now, if we trade and in one country there is no labor rights, if in one country there is no legislation to protect the environment or the quality of water or even the access to water, trade is going to accelerate things and may accelerate the bad things like the good things. But the problem is not trade. So let's always think
governance.
Governance that will require a lot of local action. And that's what we see, for instance, you know, you have countries where initially people doesn't have access to the right food or doesn't have access to income. And food trade, they may have access to low-quality food, very cheap, and they start to consume it. The problem is not trade. The problem is these people doesn't have enough income and enough option. Because trade is about options. When you go to the market, you decide what you buy. And that's where you trade.
I tend to think that trade is a good thing. And you have said trade is neutral. It's governance that makes it good or bad. So that's very interesting for me.
So trade is important. Trade in many cases is needed. But I'm also a scientist, and I look at trade. And when you're a scientist, the thing you study is not about liking it or not liking it.
Okay, that's the first thing.
Now, as we know, trade can create problems when it's happening in the wrong environment. At the end, there is another very important economist, especially when you think about trade or economic growth, that is David Ricardo. He's the father of one of the most powerful ideas in economic science, mm-hmm. that the comparative advantage.
Mm-hmm.
We are not trading because I am better than you. We are trading because you are always better to do some things related to me being relatively better to do other things. And by our differences, we get more things to actually doing. So let's say that if it takes to you 2 hours to do a podcast, but 4 hours to write a blog.
Mm-hmm.
And me, let's say that it will take me 1 hour to do a podcast,
mm-hmm.
and 3 hours to do a blog.
So then you do the podcast and I do the blog.
Exactly.
Okay.
Because if you do all of this during the full day and me the other things, at the end, we will have more blogs and more podcasts.
That's correct.
And then we can discuss how we share the benefits of it. But we have created more. So like this, you know, trade can look good. But also I start to say, okay, we have no really rules to discuss how we are going to share things, because if at the end, you know, we are in a more imperialistic relation and I say, you work, but I take the benefits and all the benefits.
But that's not trade.
It has been trade in some part of the world and in some part of history. I mean, trade within empires have not always benefited the two sides. No, the cake has increased, but the way it has been distributed was sometimes pretty unfair. I mean, during the British Empire, we know that, unfortunately, India suffered a lot,
mm-hmm.
in different manners in order to make sure that most of the value created in India end up in England, and that very few benefit from England were reaching India. So that's why when we talk about trade, we want a rule of law.
Mm-hmm.
We want strong principle.
Mm-hmm.
And the freedom of people to trade or not trade. And I think that's the most important. Mm-hmm. Because if I force you to trade, that's not the real trade we are talking about. Trade is about creating this option. And I was quoting David Ricardo. And David Ricardo was important because he was saying, you know, facing the scarcity of nature and the fact that, you know, human appetite have no limits. At one point, we are going to reach a problem and we will have a stationary state. And we have two ways to escape this: trade and technical progress. Because both help us to do more, mm-hmm. with what we have, either through the specialization, like we discussed,
mm-hmm.
or just by gain of productivity, because we become it better in what we do. So now you have AI, I have AI, you can do more podcasts, I can do more blogs.
Mm-hmm.
But technology like trade can be good or bad. You know, we cannot say, oh, technology are good. Many people would say, why you say this? It depends how you use it. And trade is the same thing. Trade increases the opportunities we have, like technology. But thinking just because it increases opportunities, it will always end up
being good,
in a better outcome for everyone, and in particular, the most vulnerable, will be a leap of faith that I don't want to do because I am a scientist, but also because it will be a bit naive. And that's what, at the end, it's good that, you know, you believe in this. Me, I want evidence of that.
So when countries are trading crops, it's not just the crops that they're trading. They're actually trading the natural resources that were required to grow those crops. No?
Yes. Because when we trade, of course, we trade a product, but beyond the product, we trade what is inside the product. And what is inside of the product is technology, labor, and of course the natural resources
water,
linked to that,
yeah.
like water, like soil health, okay? All the nutrients you get from the soil.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And in some cases, of course, it makes a lot of sense because if you are a country that have a lot of labor, you want to be able to sell this labor through the product you sell. Now, when we talk about water, when we talk about other elements linked in particular to nature or the environment, the situation becomes more complicated.
Mm-hmm.
Because yes, you need it to produce this good. And if you are in a country that doesn't have water, you want to import products that need a lot of water. Tomato, blueberry, lettuce. But this natural resource is actually potentially available in a finite amount.
Yes.
And today, it is not properly priced. So some countries are selling their product that contain a lot of water. So actually, they are exporting water. If they have a lot of water at home, that's fine. But if, for example, you will see North Africa, in the Near East, a number of countries that export a lot of horticulture product to Europe that actually water poor, that starts to become an issue.
Uh-huh.
And that's not an issue because we don't have market on water. So the export price and on the other side, the price that the partner is paying for this doesn't include the price of water. So it's a very good bargain for the importer, but potentially a cost for the exporter.
So how do you fix that?
So that's where we need to fill some gaps in this market. We need to find a way to make sure that the price of water is captured, or we need to make sure that other policy instruments, including on the export side, will avoid countries to sacrifice some of their natural resources before it's too late. But the first thing is to really do this analysis. So there is a whole range of work done on this notion of virtual water. It's how economists call it. It's basically the water that you have and you import. And it's not, once again, it's not bad in itself. It makes total sense if you are in a country that have a lot of water to produce agricultural product that need a lot of water and to send it to a country that doesn't have water.
Mm-hmm.
But if now you do it without understanding it, if you do it without tracking this water, and if you don't have a system that will capture the value of water, but you are just making a big gift and potentially creating a big problem at home, especially if you extract the water from your underground resources that will not be renewable. So, you know, are you producing these crops with renewable water or not? That will change things. So, you know, even two countries that export the same thing, we need to understand where the water comes from in order to make sure we can make the right policy recommendation. And that's what we try to do, making sure that countries, people make the right decision. We don't make the decision for them, but we want them to be informed properly.
So that sounds like we need to put a price on natural resources like water.
Yes, and that's why economists have a bad reputation. Me, I want to put price on as many things as I can in order to make sure people understand the decision they make. And non-economists will say, you are a bad guy because you try to put price on everything.
Because
and
it's
we
not...
should not put a price on water.
And but I say it that should, we should, because it's a finite
exactly.
resource.
When you have a finite resource, you need to put a price on it. Because that's where you start to, as we'll say, you know, if you like it, put a ring on it. Me, I say, if you need it, you put a price on it. And that's important. Now, how we, at the end, use the value coming from this price is a different thing. And actually, I just talk about value. And I think that when we talk about food, that also where we need to, and we try at FAO really to separate these different things. When do we talk about the cost? And that's why we talk about the cost of hidden food. We talk about the hidden cost of food. And we don't like to talk too much about the true price of food because it's already price, it costs up to different things. Price is something that you will have to pay. Price is something that people pay because it's on the markets. And then there is a value of food. And that's where, yes, food is more than a commodity. It's more than the price. And it has an important cultural, societal, human right value that I don't want to put a price on that part. But for the part that is traded on the market, I want to make sure that all the elements that go to this are reflected in one way or another. And then after, we see also how we need to provide social safety net, transfer, to make sure that people that need to buy some of this product can. So there's a full spectrum of policy instruments, but something that is free is always overused. And it's sometimes too late when things are missing. Then people say, okay, we should have managed it differently.
So it shouldn't be free. It's free because we haven't put a price on it.
Yes, and I think here we talk about two different things about when we talk about water, and let's say, okay, who wants to pay for water? I mean, we can also say, you know, accessing to water is a basic human right. And if you are too poor to pay for your water, you still be able to drink clean and fresh water. Now, when we talk about this trade and this export, it's no more basic needs or rights. It's a business. So now if I am selling you a product and I get resources that I am not paying for, and these resources matters for other people, that's where we have a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we say we need to be able to price the water in order that people make the right choice. And that's true for farmers, because if farmers doesn't have to pay for water and being also compensated, I mean that the product they sell should help them to pay for the price of water. But otherwise, how they will take the right decision, meaning should I do these crops or these crops? And if I have less and less water around, I should start to specialize in the crops that require less water. And the best way to start to move people in this direction is to tell them it costs you more money to produce the water-intensive crops than the other one. Price is a signal. It's a signal that drives investment, drives decision. And yes, if you don't have the price of water, people do not see it. Now, it's a very politically sensitive topic because farmers in most countries are already very poor.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have the money to pay for this water. And so we need to see how we do this transition. But at the end, if your country exports crops that have a lot of water and it is not captured in the price, it means that you are selling your resources for nothing. You are selling your water for nothing. If tomorrow I come with a truck, I pump your water and I cross the border, people will say, no, but what are you doing? You are going to pay for this. No, you put it in tomatoes and this becomes visible and it's free. And we want to make visible what is invisible for good decision.
I know you have been working on, you know, true cost accounting to get to the real cost of food, to reveal the true cost of food. Could you tell us, talk to us a bit about that and what governments can do to address those?
So in the last few years, we really have tried to go deeper in this understanding of what we call the hidden cost of food.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of things that are costing all societies and the individual of the society that we don't put an explicit price tag on,
mm-hmm.
but as a real economic cost. So you eat something that is going to lead to cardiac disease in the future or to get diabetes, it will impact your productivity.
Yes.
It will have, and you are the first victim of it. But sometimes when you consume the product, you don't know, or you don't fully understand that it will lead to a loss of income in 20 years from now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this intertemporal market issue. Or we can also overuse water, and that will reduce the productivity of our agricultural system in the future. So we have looked at it, and at the global level, it's at least $12 trillion, so more than 10% of the global GDP we are losing. And this is
a stunning figure, by the way.
Yes. And that's even higher share of the GDP for low-income countries.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we try to make sure that we want to reduce, because it has a high cost. So solving this problem will lead to high benefits. Now, as I've said, because we have this incomplete market, the markets are not going to solve this problem. And that's where we need policies.
Mm-hmm.
Policies redefining property rights. Policies providing more information to consumers, to actors. Taxes and subsidies that help to realigning the incentives. And of course, this is a complex process because there is a lot of moving parts.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very important to acknowledge a problem,
mm-hmm.
to put a number on the problem before starting to fix it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's why we try to do. And the goal is not even to say we should pay twice the amount we basically pay, because if you think how much this $12 trillion represent compared to the value of food, it's actually more than double. The goal is not to do this. So the cost of food is not about increasing the price of food, but also to make sure we do the right investment to avoid paying this cost. So, or you can say, I am going to, yes, increase the price of water-intensive food product to make sure we use less water, or we start to invest in technology that save water.
Uh-huh.
And so we can produce the same food, but using less water and reducing this cost, this hidden cost of water. Because paying for a solution and paying for the problem is two different things. And what we try to do is to pay for the
solutions.
We want to make sure we take the right decision today that will avoid a lot of cost in the future.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Governments do have a tool to encourage producers, and you know, it's agriculture subsidies, and they can repurpose them to encourage producers to produce certain products that are perhaps better for the environment or for people's health.
Now, subsidies is a way to reduce the cost of production of farmers in order to produce more of something. When you really target your subsidies to a specific product, or to more agriculture at a wider scale. For instance, you know, if you pay for rural transportation, if you pay for a large-scale irrigation program, or if you decide to subsidize investment in agriculture by reducing capital costs.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so these are different shape of subsidies, and some have stronger impact than others. Now, what has also take place over the years is that we know that farmers are relatively low-income people or may have challenges. And at the same time, the society is never really ready to pay this true cost of food. Meaning that if we really want to increase food prices to make sure that farmers can just survive with the price of their labor, the price of food may be too high for some consumers. And then you need to rebalance things. So one way to do it is to say, okay, we will let farmers selling below their true cost of production because we are going to subsidize it.
Mm-hmm.
Not in all countries. You know, have a few countries in the world that don't subsidize their farmers. But in general, they are a relatively rich country with very strong comparative advantage in agriculture. And now, the way that government are giving subsidies to their farmers are going to change the choice of their farmers. And that's what sometimes we have concern.
Mm-hmm.
Because government are not always the most informed about what farmers should do. So what we try to make sure is that the subsidies support the farmers and in some case also pay for the farmers for the good thing they do in terms of ecosystem services, for instance. If they help, you know, restoring biodiversity, if they help restoring land that have been degraded, if they just also contribute to the food security of my country,
mm-hmm.
they deliver a public good.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And it makes sense to take money from the taxpayer to give it to the farmers.
Mm-hmm.
So we can justify subsidies.
Mm-hmm.
But what we don't want is that these subsidies create a lot of inefficiencies. or that the government decide who are the winners and losers. You do soybean, you get a subsidy. You do blueberry, you don't get a subsidy. Why? You know? Is it really a justification in terms of how you manage your water, how you manage your land, how it's important for the food security of your country? Or it's just depending on your political power? Because you are part of a country that have a strong political connection versus another part. Because you produce the same commodity than the family of the president. Unfortunately, that's sometimes how policy are made. And that's not this. I mean, I'm not here to say how things should be done. As I said, that it's pretty an inefficient manner to do it, and that the welfare of your country will not be increased by that.
Said like an economist.
Yes. So, yes, we want to sometimes repurpose these policies. And when we say about repurposing, it's also to make sure that we really think about what we want to achieve with these subsidies. What is the value for the community? What is the value for the taxpayer? Because subsidies come from the taxpayer. Yes. And what we have seen over the years, things have evolved. You know, when we were living the Second World War, we had actually countries in Europe that have non-famine, in other parts of the world too. So the goal was to produce more. Whatever the environmental cost is to make sure that people doesn't know famine again.
Yep.
And because we had the war, we remember that, oh no, your neighbor may not be your best friend. Of the ships coming from Latin America can be sunk by some U-boat in the Atlantic. So you say local production is needed when we are not in a world where peace is there, when the multilateral system is not very strong. You start to say, okay, let's bring things closer. And we use subsidies. It was done in Europe. It was done in India. Green Revolution. We need to produce more to feed our people. And first of all, to feed our people with staple. A loaf of bread, a bowl of rice.
Yes.
Then we started to say, oh, sometimes it's too successful. We are producing too much.
Too much.
And also, this race of producing more sometimes have really even hurt the income of our farmers. Because we have surplus, the price collapse. So we say, okay, we need actually to use this money to support the income of our farmers. Because also we still want to maintain people in rural area. Because we were starting to see in the 70s, really this exodus in many parts, people leaving rural area to going to cities. And so we need to inject income in rural area, but maybe not through agricultural subsidies, as subsidy to commodity to produce more, but just to keep farmers. Then entering in the 90s, we start to say, oh, but we start to have environmental problems. We need to pay for saving water. We want to pay to reduce emission. We even potentially want to pay to improve animal welfare because lack of animal welfare can lead to more zoonotic disease. So we start to pay for, you know, other things. And now we start to say, oh, but maybe what we produce is linked to what we eat. And we start to have obesity crises. So do we still need to put so much subsidies on sugar? So over time, the priority of the societies have changed. And even today, they are not the same everywhere in the world. So this is why there is no one size fits all in terms of recommendation. But because what we want to achieve has evolved, the type of subsidies we use has to evolve also. And this is this negotiation, this discussion about repurposing, you know?
How do you choose where to spend the limited resources you have?
So that's the art of policies. You know, we try to find the balance between these different trade-offs. Because all of this matter, normally you will try to do a bit of all of that. So depending, you know, where you are, of course, you are going to put different weight. I mean, if you're in a place where you have a lot of water, saving water is not going to be essential. If you're in a place where water is scarce and you have a lot of money, let's say you are in some Gulf countries, you may not care so much about what is the fiscal cost of your policy, but you want to make sure that you get the right social outcome and potentially the right water outcome. Because each of the decisions we make is linked to some trade-off. I mean, there is a few very simple solutions in life. And as economists, we will call them, you know, they are Pareto optimal. When you can increase everything at the same time, they are not very difficult, you know, decisions.
Yeah, you can
to
do
make.
Like, you can do
they
everything.
Can, it's happened. If you have the right information, the right technology, you can say, you know, guys, we can do more of this and more of this. Because people have given us money, or because now we have a supercomputer, and now we can do three things when before we were able to do one.
Because you're not choosing, right? You're not choosing.
Sometimes
you
we still have situation where people are not in what we call this frontier of efficiency. And we need to bring it. But then trade-offs start to appear when we have to move along this frontier. When it's difficult to increase what we give on one side without taking on the other. And there is a full hierarchy of trade-off. The first one, the most important one, is about today versus tomorrow. How much am I going to restrain my consumption today in order that my next generation can still consume? Then you have a trade-off about, or if I am a policymaker, should I spend money in agriculture or in education? If I spend money in agriculture, do I want to protect my smallholders or to boost my export by focusing on my large, very competitive farms? Do you want to start to make less money and protect more the environment? But when I talk about the environment, do I try to maximize the protection of nature and biodiversity, or should I try to maximize the amount of carbon I will keep in my soil and in my forest? That's not the same answer.
Mm-mm.
We are talking about government. I will say the same thing for farmers. Earlier in my career, you know, I was talking with a smallholders in Central America, and he was telling me, you know, I am here. You see the forest nearby. This is my trees. I like my trees, but if I have to decide about cutting the trees and sending my daughter to school, I cut the trees. Now, our goal is to make sure that it doesn't have to make this choice. So at the end, what we do is that we put different weight on that. That reflects the state of our society, yes. You know, a country that have a lot of young population and a country that have aging population will not look at this in the same way. We also not look at how we weight the present versus the future. So really, I think, you know, we have to accept, and that we're getting this concert of nation, talking together here at FAO, in other multilateral arenas so important, because we are different, okay? And we should not force everyone to think the same thing or to have the same preferences. But being different doesn't mean that we cannot get an agreement. Because, you know, trade is about benefiting from differences. If we were all the same, we would not trade. It's because we trade, we can become richer. And because we are different, and we still manage to find an agreement, that even among nations, we can do better things, because we can increase the space of choice, okay? That's what we do when we trade goods. Here we are in the trade of ideas, in trade of solution. And we can design better systems through technology, but also through better governance. So we can find a way for the farmers to protect these trees if these trees represent a value for him. And it represents a value for him because actually it represents a value for the society. It represents a value for the cities that actually use water that go through its land. And with healthier forest, you get cleaner water. And the people in cities are rich enough to pay more for their water, that the fee on this water will help the farmer to send his daughter to school and at the same time to farm and keep trees. But you see, it required to get a bit of sophistication. It required to do a lot of computations to get there.
Mm.
And when we have a country that have to deal, you know, with young population, old population, that's actually where the multilateral system is so important about, because we have a global population. We have young people in one place, old people in the other. Old people have the capital, young people have the labor. And you are not forced to let a kid hungry. If actually this kid, you want him to grow, to be productive, Because all people, in order to survive, will need to consume products and services. They will not produce it. It will be the next generation that produce it. So making sure that your old people invest in the future of the young generation is so important. When it was taking place within the border of a country, we had a social contract about this. You have pension system. We know that we pay for public education because the next generation will pay for pension. Okay? But now the scale has to go beyond the border. And that's why transfer is important. Transfer of capital, transfer of technology, migration, all of these have to play a role to make sure we can rebalance the system. And also, no country is doomed to disappear. Over centuries of history, we have seen birth rate going up and down, depending on technology, option, but also the hope of people. And a good way to say, you know, there is a future is to make sure we make a future possible. And so we also invest in the future. We protect the ecosystems. And like this, people will say, oh, yes, maybe I want to raise a kid because this kid will have a future. And thinking that, oh, no, it's too late. It's a bit sad. And I would say in any case, mankind will find a way to survive and adapt. What we want to make sure is that we leave no one behind during this trip.
Thank you, David.
Thank you, Catherine.